J. Trump has been inaugurated as the 47th president of the United States. And whilst much of the world has been recalibrating since his electoral victory back in November, he comes to power with the US facing significant challenges. US credibility, America's global order, America's tech lead, and national unity are all facing major ruptures, and the American people have turned to the former reality TV star to make America great again. Here to help us make sense of this all is GeoPolity founder Adnan Khan. Before we meet Adnan, I just want to remind everyone you can find us on all major social media platforms where you can subscribe and you'll never miss a thing. How are you doing, Adnan?
I'm good, Yusuf. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I think this is quite exciting for us. Big things happening at GeoPolity.
It is. It's our first one for 2025 as well.
Yeah, definitely. Now, before we get into it, there's a few things that Donald Trump, he said before he even got into the White House. He talked about conquering Greenland, the Panama Canal, and the Gulf of Mexico. Adnan, what would you say are America's key strategic issues? Is it these things that Donald Trump is talking about?
Yes, I'm really glad, Yusuf, you started with this question, because presidents come and go. Presidents have a term. And, you know, in my lifetime, I've seen quite a few presidents come and go. But you find the underlying challenges they face, they don't generally change from president to president. And whilst Donald Trump seems to have some new love for Greenland and the Gulf of Mexico, the reality here is there are some significant strategic challenges whoever would have been the president has to deal with. And I would say, Yusuf, there's five of these currently. Probably the most important is wealth inequality. This is actually the source of all problems in America. It's the reason why Donald Trump is actually in power. Because the economy just doesn't work for a large chunk of the American population, they've turned to a populist. They've turned to a complete outsider. And I've not really heard much from Donald Trump how he plans to deal with the economic inequality in the country. There is a lot of talk, which I'm sure we're going to touch on, about immigration, about tariffs. However, when I think 10% of the population owns about 70% of the wealth, this is actually the source of all the problems, which we haven't really heard much from Trump, how he plans to specifically deal with it. Then you've got the national debt. The national debt is $36 trillion at the moment. America is required to repay over $1 trillion a year in interest repayments. This is a ticking time bomb. Donald Trump has said absolutely nothing about how he plans to deal with this. Then you've got demographics. I think, Yusuf, 2050, the Caucasian population of America will be a minority. So white fly, white Americans feeling their country is completely changing. This is another major issue that they're going to have to actually deal with. And we're not really hearing much from Donald Trump how he plans to deal with the declining demographics in the country. America's tech lead, China, seems to be well advanced than America on all the next generation of technologies. And I'm sure this is something we're going to discuss. And probably finally is American soft power. America's credibility, American dream, Hollywood, all of this have taken a major hit. America's global liberal order is really no longer credible as it used to be. So whoever would have been the president, whether it was Kamala Harris or if Biden continued or Trump, these are the actual challenges America faces. And whoever would have been president, this is what their focus really would need to be.
Now, there's a lot to unpack there, Adnan, and I hope we can get through a lot of these topics. But I just want to start off with something that's been going on recently with Donald Trump and Elon Musk. They've both been very big on the news recently. Elon Musk with his interference in European politics. They've both been talking about the Panama Canal, about Greenland. What do you make of this? Where do these guys both stand in relation to these issues?
So if you take your mind back to Trump's first term, there was a lot of bluster. There's a lot of talk about building a wall between Mexico and America that apparently the Mexicans were going to pay for. And here we are, what, 10 years later, there's no wall and Trump doesn't talk about it anymore. So I feel what Trump has done here is this is bluster again. He's talking about things which get headlines. They're great for his crowd, but nobody really believes he's going to deliver. And even if he doesn't deliver, nobody really takes it seriously anyway. So Greenland, America has access to it anyway. Greenland is a territory in the Arctic that belongs to Denmark. America already has a base there. It has a missile base there. It has access to it. The Panama Canal, America's military has priority access if they ever need it. So why do you need to take them over if you're already getting what you need from it? And then the Gulf of Mexico being called the Gulf of America, quite frankly, who cares? You're on some seas. Who cares what it's actually called? So I think these are things where Donald Trump says them. Social media goes a bit mad. But in terms of physically delivering on them, they will take too long and people are really going to forget anyway. The key thing is, as I mentioned, is the strategic issues. He's not talking about them in details. He's not talking about them in depth. So every time he talks bluster, he's deflecting from the real strategic issues. And I think that's really the context we have to put it in. And I think Musk is doing the same thing as well. Obviously, Elon Musk, now that he's in the cabinet, he's an oligarch. He's got some views on politics as well. But he seems to be a bit pro-right wing. He seems to support Tommy Robinson, who has very little, who has virtually no support in the UK. He's supporting the neo-Nazi party, the AfD, in Germany. So again, all of this is talk, really. Great for the media, great for pundits. In practice, it doesn't really deal with any of the key issues going on.
One of the things that I wanted to discuss with you, Adnan, was Trump's choice in cabinet ministers. What do you make of them?
So it's quite interesting, Yusuf. We're used to parts of the world in banana republics where leaders pick their kids, they pick their children, they pick their loyalists. And what we're seeing with Donald Trump is loyalists are coming into the cabinet over experience. And loyalty is measured by how much you've defended Donald Trump in public, how much you've defended Donald Trump in private, and how much you've defended some of the things he said that are indefensible. We got to keep in mind that 24 of his first term appointments fell out with him. Some of the most experienced guys, John Bolton, Ted Tillerson, all of these guys actually fell out with him. The other thing, if we're generally looking at his cabinet picks, is all of them are Zionists and all of them are MAGA supporters, Make America Great Again. So what he's really done is people who are like him, who have been loyal to him, that's who he's actually picked. So the people from industry, people with a background in government, in defense, in the military, in education, that had actually nothing to do with it. What Donald Trump's done is he's purely gone for loyalty over experience. So this already ran into trouble straight away, because in America, the way it works is when you have your cabinet picks, Congress has to authorize them. So Matt Gaetz, he was supposed to be the attorney general. He was a bit of a shocking pick because he's a bit of a conspiracy theorist. He had to withdraw his candidacy in the end because his sexual encounters became public. And his replacement is Pam Bondi, who is a hardcore Trump supporter. She is part of his legal team with all the cases he had. You've got Tulsi Gabbard, who's the director of national intelligence. She's actually considered a Russian asset. She has no intelligence experience. At most, she's been an army reservist in the past. So literally, she has no experience, no knowledge of the department she's going to be managing. And the department is to do with intelligence. Then you've got Peter Hegseth. He scraped through in the end as Secretary of Defense. He has a long history of sexual encounters. He was a mid-ranking officer in the National Guard. So he's not actually been in the main military. So he actually lacks relevant experience when it comes to defense. Then you've got Robert F. Kennedy, Secretary of Health and Human Services. He's been a long-term skeptic of vaccinations and had very unorthodox views. So a lot of the health industry have been quite shocked. And then Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, they're the head of a new department, the Department of Government Efficiency. And we just have to keep in mind that Elon Musk contributed $250 million to Trump's election campaign. If he didn't do that, he probably wouldn't be in government. So literally, the things we're used to seeing in the third world, in banana republics, it has now come to the superpower country.
I'm sure we'll see these people up on the news over the next 4 years with what they're up to, especially Elon Musk. With America, one of its most important regions, or the region that he wants to focus most of its time, has always been, or for the last few years, has been China. the South China Sea, China becoming a growing power. What is the US policy currently? Do you think Trump's going to carry on with that? I remember last time he was he started the trade war with China. Are we going to see more of that in the next 4 years?
So whoever's the president, America has designated China as a peer competitor. China is a country that has grown significantly. It's growing militarily. It's grown economically. So it poses a threat to the American order, to how America believes how the world should be. So whoever would have been president would have designated China as the number one priority. Where the presidents differ then is how they specifically deal with it. So successive administrations, really going back to the George W. Bush era, they have been quite consistent when it comes to China, that China is a competitor and we have to confront her. So what we've seen with Biden and Obama before him is they prioritize alliance building in the Southeast Asia region to create a containment line around China. And what we've seen since Trump came in is he was more focused on getting immediate, tangible results. So sanctions, tariffs, that's the line he went with. So it's likely Trump, he will be harsh with regional allies, South Korea, Japan, Australia, because he wants them to take more of the burden of defense in that particular region. Trump has in his election campaign emphasized that he wants to decouple America from China. Or he wants to reduce the economic links between both countries. On the other hand, what we're seeing is Trump started the economic war and Biden expanded the trade war, and that is probably going to continue. I think already some goods are supposed to have 100% tariffs when Trump comes into power. So America will continue with its confrontational policy with China. I think it'll be interesting to see how China actually responds to this. And it will be interesting to see how aggressive Trump actually gets, but he's not really interested in anything long-term that he could actually do with China. He wants immediate results.
One thing that you mentioned with his relationship with America's allies, he seems very confrontational even towards them. So, forcing them to pay towards the NATO budget, telling them to increase it. I remember from last time he was very confrontational with Germany and Angela Merkel. What's your view on that? Are we going to see more of this? Is he going to bully his allies the way he bullies his enemies?
Yes, that's Trump's way of ruling. His ruling is forget alliances, forget long-term relationships. He's a very transactional-driven leader. So he doesn't have a problem talking or negotiating with Putin or Xi or the North Korean leader as long as the deal's right. And he uses the same principle with long-term allies of America as well. So you're right, Angela Merkel, he bullied. He bullied the Canadian leader. He actually bullied quite severely the Japanese leader, the South Korean leader at the time. So this is his way of actually doing it. Now, whether that's good for America, the different discussion. Does that create the right image? Is that really what America should be doing? Well, absolutely not. People in America have so many question marks over the future of America. They need a leader that has principles. They need a leader that actually creates a good image about America. So yeah, he will definitely continue with that. That's his way of doing politics.
You mentioned Trump is very transactional. Obviously, this is really partly the reason why he got into power in the first place with the economic inequality in America. What do you think his economic policy is going to be for the US over the next 4 years?
So Trump has talked quite a lot about, in fact, Trump's whole campaign has been, I'm going to clean the swamp. People turn to him because the economic situations are so bad. So he's been talking a lot about making sweeping economic policy changes. Broadly speaking, he's really hot on tariffs. Tariffs, tariffs, tariffs. You cannot have enough tariffs. He's talking about 100% tariffs, even more than 100%. And so tariffs is a tax US importers pay on goods they import. For how exactly this deals with China remains to be seen, because it's not China who pays the tax. It's the American importer that actually pays the tax. Then Trump's been talking a lot about cutting taxes, about deregulation, and cracking down on immigration. Somehow immigration is going to fix the American economy. So really, Trump's economic policy is all geared around the complete opposite to what America's been advocating for so long. It's about protectionism. It's about tariffs. It's about sanctions. It's about restrictions. It's about economic nationalism. The complete opposite to free trade, free markets, globalization, all of these sort of things. And Trump made this clear in the first term. He doesn't really believe in globalization. He believes more in nationalism and national interests. And that's what he's going to continue with. Whether that even solves America's economic issues, it remains questionable.
I was reading today about this point with many Republicans actually not completely being in favor of this view that Trump has, this shift in an ideological perspective. Do you think you will be able to push these policies through? For example, the increase in tariffs, do you think they're going to get through Congress?
So I think, yeah, you're right. He will run into some problems because different states depend differently on imports and different states have different supply chains. So he might run into trouble, although he does have a small majority in one house and a slightly larger one in the other house. Also, I think as his term goes on, just the reality of ruling will happen because what's good for New York may not necessarily be good for California. So I think he will, and we've generally seen that the likely chances in within 2 years, he will lose one of the houses out of the two. And then the problems will begin. And that usually is what happens in America. And then, you know, you mentioned because Trump is not ideological, he really looks for policies where immediate results can come about. So he doesn't look at the implications. He doesn't look about building in the long term. He doesn't look at if I do this policy now, what will be the negative impacts as well? And this will come and haunt him as he goes on. So I think, you know, Trump may be creating his own problems later on down the line.
If we focus on the domestic policy, obviously he's changed his stance a little bit with immigration. His first term, he was very, very anti-immigration. Now it seems like he's more directed it to illegal immigration. So he managed to get the Hispanics on board. What do we see his domestic policy? What do you think his domestic policy is going to be like in comparison to his first term?
So his domestic policy is really going to be the bulk of his term. The foreign policy issues, they're there, but they're not going to be the biggest thing that's going to affect him. He's got this huge MAGA support base, Make America Great Again. And for them, their issues are the economy, their issues are immigration. So he's going to have to focus on that. So he's already mentioned that he wants to effectively deport undocumented individuals in America. Now, how he does that is up in the air. Are you going to be going door to door? Are you going to leave it down to the states? In his first term, if you remember, people that were coming across the border, they divided the children from their parents. And you had this scenario where it looked like it was a traffic zone. So we'll have to wait and see how he does it. But he seems to be quite hard on this. That, in fact, the solution to most of America's problems are dealing with undocumented individuals. Then you've got the Rust Belt area. These are the areas that have deindustrialized over the years because trade, manufacturing has moved over to China and other countries. He hasn't actually given a detailed plan how he's going to bring that back, but a lot of Trump's supporters are from the Rust Belt area. So these are areas where industries declined, where there is no manufacturing, where cheaper manufacturing is coming in from Mexico and China. And this is, again, something he talks about a lot, but he hasn't really presented a detailed policy on this. Then you've got all these woke issues. Trump's been very clear, a woman's a woman, a man's a man, all this LGBTQ, his support base is dead against these sort of things. And he's been very clear that he wants to reverse a lot of the woke laws in the army and in the country. He wants to actually reverse them. The final thing, which is probably the most critical, is Trump's transition plan was written by the Heritage Foundation, probably more on the most right-wing think tanks in America. And what they come up with was Project 2025. This is a project really to alter the balance within America. So you've got the federal government, then you've got the states. And a lot of implementation isn't done by the White House or the government. It's done by the broader civil service. It's done by the different departments. And it's done at state level. What this plan is they want to take away powers from the states and bring it completely to the White House. So what happens is the White House comes up with a policy. Everyone else's job is purely to implement. They're only involved in implementation. They're not involved in anything else. Now, this is going to create a few issues because this is going to bump up against the deep state. It's going to bump up against the military-industrial complex. And this is really an agenda to alter the balance of power within the US. And this is something definitely we're going to be watching at the geopolitics. And there's a whole grand plan to do this. He's already picked his cabinet who supports this. So that's definitely going to be something to watch. So Trump has quite a big domestic program. Despite all the foreign policy issues, he's actually got a significant domestic program. And it remains to be seen how much of it he can achieve.
It seems like there's certain things that have already been attributed to Trump as a success. So the recent ceasefire in Gaza, a lot of people are attributing it to Trump and not Biden, because Biden's had 15 months to sort it out and he's not got any anywhere. Trump's about to come in and straight away there's a ceasefire in place. Are we seeing a shift in American foreign policy in the region with Trump coming in? Or was it just Biden trying to get one last win before he's out?
So you're absolutely right. How is it for 15 months, 13 months to 15 months, Biden has proposed a ceasefire plan. Netanyahu's been dragging his feet. And then all of a sudden, Trump's Middle East envoy, Witkoff, he goes and literally humiliates Netanyahu that this is a ceasefire plan and you need to implement it. And we've seen it. They've been doing it over Saturday, Sunday, when the ceasefire actually began. So what happened is from November, when Trump won the election, he had some of his cabinet already chosen. So they've been working on some policy areas with the Biden administration. We've got to keep in mind, Yusuf, Biden, as we saw during the election campaign, he's mentally not there anymore. So really, Trump's come in, or his picks have come in, and they've already been working with it. So let's see. I think, the ceasefire is a ceasefire. It's a temporary stop halting of a massacre. It doesn't deal with the underlying issues of occupation, of slaughter, of genocide, of a nation state. So let's see where it goes. But, it does beg the question, everything America's done over the last week, why could they not have done that 15 months ago? Why could they not have come down hard on Netanyahu? Which shows you, actually, that the problem was always Netanyahu. The problem was never Hamas agreeing to terms. It was actually Israel all along. The fact that they've agreed to it now and they've been blaming on Hamas all this time, why did you agree to it now? Because it's the same terms that Biden proposed back in May, I think it was. So let's see how it goes. But Trump likes to take credit. He likes to work like this, very short term. I mean, it's very likely we have a 45-day ceasefire in Palestine. There's supposed to be another two stages. Whether we get there or not remains to be seen. So whilst this ceasefire is getting all the headlines, really, apart from the exchange of some hostages, apart from aid going in, and apart from a halt to the fighting, none of the other issues have actually been dealt with. So Trump, he loses attention pretty quickly. He likes to get the headlines, he's done something. And we saw this when he went to North Korea during his first term. He went there, and nothing came off it in the end. He went there, they made an agreement to talk more. He didn't go again, and nothing came off it. So, let's watch this space.
Another war that Trump said he would end in 24 hours is the Russia-Ukraine war. Obviously, that's going into its third year now, I think. What do you think US policy is going to be on that? Do you think he's going to stop it in 24 hours?
So they've already backtracked on that now. Now they're saying it's going to take longer. So surprise, surprise. This is even before Trump's taken before the inauguration. His team said that was just bluster for the election. They've actually admitted it. I think the important thing here is, Yusuf, that firstly, America and Russia have always been competing in Eurasia. That is the fundamental difference between them. Russia is in Eurasia. It's been a Eurasian power in the past, and it wants to dominate Eurasia. It believes it has a right to be the dominant power in Eurasia. For America, its competitor will arise in Eurasia, and if one power dominates Eurasia, it then has the resources now to take on America. So whoever the president is, they will always see Russia in this way, despite any short periods of cooperation. So in that context, Yusuf, Ukraine is just one small part of the overall competition between Russia and America. And unfortunately, I don't think the Ukrainian people realize that America has this battle going on across Eurasia with Russia. Ukraine is one small dot in that grand scheme of things. And that's why America was never going to put in full resources for Ukraine to win. What they needed was Ukraine to bog Russia down, which they did. America now has 13,000 sanctions on Russia, which has now been achieved. And now, I think in February, we're coming to 3 years since the war began. Now all the talk is, we've given you money, we've given you arms, you need to now get on with it. And if you can't get on with it, then now it's time to talk peace still. Now it's time to talk about a ceasefire and bringing this to an end. So even before Trump's come in, the winding down of America's support was already in motion. So Trump's really just continuing with what the existing position is anyway. And the fact that Trump's team rolled back in the 24 hours really shows you that, again, that was just a bluster. With Trump, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this a lot over his term, is, you know, what's bluster and what's real? And what does it say and what does it really mean to act upon? But in the issue of Ukraine, apart from 24 hours, really everything is going in the direction where let's wind this down. The competition between the both countries, that's not winding down. That will just move to another part of the world. For the Ukrainians, it, you know, what they see as victory is very different to what America sees as victory. And they're finding that out now. And I think the Ukrainians are now officially the Kurds of Europe. The Kurds learned the hard way what it means to get in bed with America. Now the Ukrainians are learning that.
Final question for you, Adnan. What do you imagine the political landscape to be like at the next election after a full term of Trump in 2029?
So we're going to be close to the 2030s then. So it'll be quite interesting what the world's like. I think what we've got to put into perspective, Yusuf, is Trump coming into power now isn't where America's strong. It's not where America has credibility. In fact, all the talk in America and around the world is of malaise and decline. This is the context Trump is coming to power in. And I feel America is looking more and more like the USSR. In 1985, Gorbachev was picked by the Communist Party to stop the rot and to reform and take the USSR in the correct direction. He came in 1985, within 6 years, the Soviet Union had collapsed. The Americans have turned to Trump in the hope that he can reverse the decline and stop the rot. The Soviets went into Afghanistan. Gorbachev pulled them out. They still declined and they still collapsed. America has just come out of Afghanistan and it's the latest. If for some reason, empires go into Afghanistan and then they collapse in the end. It happened with the British, happened with the Soviets. Let's see if it happened with the Americans. And the third area where America is looking more and more like the USSR is when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, everybody expected the Red Army to go in and put down the rebellion. It didn't. And that showed to everyone the Soviets are, they're a done force. They're done. They're finished. And we saw after 1989, one by one, all the different republics left and then the Soviet Union collapsed. America has undermined the global liberal order that has been promoted for such a long time. Just 2 weeks ago, Congress passed a law that they're going to sanction the ICC. They're sanctioning a court, not an individual, a court. Now, this is what cartels do. This is what the mafia does. So the global liberal order has been completely undermined by America itself. So I actually feel America is looking more and more like the USSR, and actually, what you need currently is an ideological person, a principal person in the White House, someone who shows the world America stands for something, we believe in it, and we stick to it, and it brings the rest of the world to it. This is what they did after World War II with the whole capitalist system, capitalist bloc during the Cold War. The guy they've got in the White House, he's the complete opposite. He believes in transactional relationships. He doesn't believe in alliances. He believes they can make a deal even with America's enemies. So 2029-30, I think, Yusuf, things will be far worse than they are even today.
Thank you for your time today, Adnan. And thank you guys for listening. As always, you can find many more articles, comprehensive insights and deep dives on our website. That's www.thegeopolity.com. Thank you for listening.